Hello, and welcome back to Astronomy News with the Cosmic Companion. This week, we welcome Professor Seiji Sugita of the University of Tokyo to the show. He is a researcher on the Hayabusa 2 mission, which recently brought the first large sample of an asteroid to Earth. But first, we take a look at a new study teaching us how spiders react to living in space. Next, we journey to the exoplanet HD106906b and learn what it could teach us about a possible unseen planet at the edge of our own solar system. Finally, we'll take a look at the first large samples of an asteroid ever to arrive on Earth before we talk to one of the researchers on this historic mission. Researchers at the University of Basel examined two experiments conducted in 2008 and 2011 in which spiders were brought to the International Space Station to see how they would adapt to life in space. Webs built by these spiders were more symmetrical than webs constructed on Earth, and spiders changed their hunting techniques. However, researchers found that simulating sunlight in the chambers drove the spiders to construct webs similar to those found here at home, suggesting light is an important tool spiders use in constructing their silky nets. Located roughly 336 light years from Earth, the exoplanet HD106906b may teach us about Planet X, a theoretical unseen planet at the edge of our solar system. This exoplanet, 11 times as massive as Jupiter, may have formed fairly close to its pair of parent stars. Drag from a disk of gas and dust could have sent the planet spiraling inward before being sent out to a far-flung, if stable, orbit. It is possible an unseen ninth planet in our own solar system might have followed a similar path, researchers speculate. On December 22nd, we'll talk to Dr. Paul Collis, an astronomer at UC Berkeley, who helped lead this study. The Hayabusa 2 mission to collect material from the asteroid Ryugu has successfully dropped its cargo on Earth. The sample was found to contain gas, which researchers carefully collected as the sample container was opened. It is uncertain so far if this gas found with the sample is native to the asteroid. The canister will be carefully emptied of its precious cargo and the material analyzed. Analysis of this rare material could help researchers learn more about the early solar system, including the formation of Earth.
Looking deep into the universe, we see backwards in time, and the oldest light in the universe holds secrets to how everything around us will, one day, end. Meanwhile, stars, planets, and galaxies dance in an intricate ballet, occasionally giving birth to life. We are a fledgling species, just beginning to visit other worlds. We are a way for the universe to understand itself. The Cosmic Companion strives to bring the universe down to Earth, and we depend on your help to make it happen. For information on subscriptions and ways to donate to this program, please visit thecosmiccompanion.net. Thank you.
Next up, we talk to Professor Seiji Sugita of the University of Tokyo, researcher on this fascinating study.
This week on Astronomy News with the Cosmic Companion, we're happy to be joined once again by Professor Seiji Sugita from the University of Tokyo. He is a researcher on the Hayabusa 2 mission, which recently returned the first large samples of an asteroid to Earth. Welcome to the show, Seiji.
Thank you, James. Thank you for having me here again. It's such an honor to talk to your audience.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to have you back. So just to let people know, what do we know so far about the asteroid Ryugu and what makes it such an interesting target to study?
Okay, after a year and a half of intensive observation with the Hayabusa 2, we know a lot more about the Ryugu now than just before the arrival. We had little knowledge about the asteroid except for a few important things. But now I think we have three important properties of Ryugu: a shape, carbon, and water. Number one, shape. It has a so-called top-shaped, just like the my virtual background.
So behind you.
Yeah, it's spinning like a top, and then it's a axisymmetric. If you look from the top, it's a perfect sphere, but it looks like a diamond shape from the side, and then it's spinning this way. And then the size is very small. It's like almost exactly 1 kilometer in diameter, which is about 0.6 miles across. And then the surface is, and then number two is the carbon. The surface is very dark. This is one of the darkest objects in the solar system. Comets are very dark, known to be dark, but this particular asteroid turns out to be as dark as a comet surface. And the reflectance is less than actually 2%. Only 2% of light is coming from the surface compared to the sunlight. And then this darkness is probably most likely comes from the high abundance of carbon. So organic matter, which is carbon-based molecules, and also building blocks of our body, of life, are also very likely to be contained. So we hope to be able to find many carbon-based molecules from the samples we obtained just recently. And the third element is water. Water is a very important ingredient of life, and also ocean and other things on the Earth. And we have found evidence for water, but chemically bound in the minerals, not the liquid water, but the chemically bound minerals on Ryugu. We call those minerals that contain water hydrated minerals. And clay is one of the most typical hydrated minerals. We don't think we have, we may have clays, but some other little more obscure form of hydrated minerals on Ryugu. That's something we would have to find out from samples. Then also, the amount of water on Ryugu is substantially less than we thought before the arrival. And also, maybe we talk about it later, but Bennu is a NASA's, U.S. NASA's missions target asteroid. Very similar shape and color, but they found much more abundance of chemically bound water on Bennu. So the contrasting difference between Bennu and Ryugu in terms of water abundance is a very interesting and puzzling question we're asking ourselves, and hopefully we can answer those questions by sample analysis. So that's the sort of what we know about Ryugu in a nutshell. It's a little long-winded, but that's what we think we know.
That's so informative. So do you think that possibly the difference in water content means that Bennu and Ryugu have come from different sources, or are they from?
Yeah, we have a multiple hypotheses, and then maybe all of them are wrong. But they are, like you said, there are generally two schools of thought. Like you said, one which I hope to be truth is that those Rigu and Bennu are from two different parent bodies. They were formed in slightly different locations in the solar system early on, and somehow the amount of water was different, and then there must have been some kind of mechanism to determine the amount of water in early on, and then depending on which type of asteroids come into the Earth later on the solar system evolution, the amount of water we receive in the Earth and terrestrial, other terrestrial planets like Venus or Mars could be controlled by those frequency of impact. So that has an important implication. The other school of thought is that maybe Bennu and Rigu are born in possibly the same parent body, the same initial water abundance, and then somehow it lost the water through the evolution, possibly by impact and the degassing and the water gets evaporated, or maybe in the process of going to the proximity to the sun in the recent history of orbital evolution, it may have evaporated. And then we don't see as much water on Rigu than Bennu. So then there are a lot of slightly divided hypotheses right now. So that's just the general style that's sort of understanding.
That is so fascinating. And of course, you mentioned all the carbon, you know, the carbon-based molecules that you're expecting to find within the sample. And so, of course, when you think carbon, one of the first things that springs to mind often is, as you mentioned, life. Right. And so there's been some fascinating research going on lately talking about how the building blocks of life, or possibly even life itself, could be transported, especially through asteroids. Are you going to be able to detect any of those materials in in your research?
The short answer to that profound question is, of course, yes and no. You know, it's a silly answer, and I hate to say that. But the no part is that because we haven't opened the canister yet, we don't know what's inside yet. And that's an official statement, I have to say. I mean, you can't speculate, but it's meaningless. But the yes part is actually we can say even more strongly today than just a week ago. The condition of the container or the capsule of Hayabusa 2 is really perfect. It cannot be better than that. That's a really wonderful news. If the return of capsule was not as good as it did, or maybe the amount of time it took from arrival to the Earth's atmosphere to the retrieval, finding, and bringing to the safe location in the vacuum chamber, maybe some Earth's atmosphere gradually gets into the system. And you can't have a 100% air tightness. I mean, it's really tight, but we're talking about ppb and ppm, very low amount of high detectability of those biomolecules. But I think that the samples we have from Hayabusa 2 is as good as it can be. As Earth, so we call it Earth contamination, as Earth contamination free as possible. So whatever molecules that could be useful for generating life on Earth in the sample, it is born in the space, not the contamination from the ground. That's something we can say for sure. So it's up to what kind of molecules we will find in coming months and maybe years of time. And then in the past, in a meteoritic sample, even if we find some really great molecules such as amino acid, sugars, and lipid, those is difficult to distinguish between the real meteoritic sample or Earth contaminated. But that issue is taken care of from this Hayabusa sample. The meteoritic analysis and study in the past have shown a great possibility of finding those molecules. So we hope to be able to find these exciting molecules in the near future.
That's so interesting. And so, of course, that begs the question of how is this done? Can you tell us a little bit about the Hayabusa 2 spacecraft and how it went out and captured a little bit of this fabulous asteroid?
Okay, thank you. Let me then go through the first it got launched, right? And then it went to this asteroid and then made a global observation with the instrument. And among them is my instrument, which is a visible camera on a multi-band camera. And then along with that, thermal infrared and the near infrared spectrometers, and then laser altimeter, those were used to characterize. And then we went close to the surface, made a very detailed observation, and then chose a place to land. And then we got the first sample from the touchdown one. We call it touchdown instead of a landing because it just touches and it goes. And not really landing very stably. It is effective because it's a very low gravity asteroid. And then after that, we made an artificial impact. This was the first time to have a man-made crater on the surface of an asteroid. Then we excavated material from subsurface. Subsurface material is extremely useful or precious because it hasn't experienced a major so-called space weathering. Organic matters and other delicate matters could be altered if you expose those material in your space for a long time. It's not good for analyzing biomolecules. So bringing some subsurface material on the ground was a very important process. And then we landed on the ejecta deposit excavated from the subsurface of Ryugu made by the impact crater. Then that's the second touchdown. Then after a little while, we left Ryugu in this November of last year. Then about a year of time of cruising, we came to the Earth on the 6th of December of this year, just 1 week ago. Can't believe that was just 1 week ago. But came down to the Australia. We have a very good relationship. Australia, my goodness, the COVID-19 situation didn't help us at all. But the Australian government and then the local scientists were extremely, extremely helpful. And then they really helped us. And then about 80 people from JAXA went through the Australia after the self-quarantining, 2 weeks. 2 weeks in Japan, 2 weeks in Australia. Went to the desert and obtained the capsule. Then brought in the next day. They found in the same day, just after the dawn, they detected the beacon signal really close to where it looked like landed, based on the optical and the radio navigation, and then a helicopter found it as soon as light came in, and then the bush was retrapping the parachute, then landing, and then grabbed the capsule. Then on the night of the 7th, they left the Australia in a pretty small chartered airplane, jet airplane. And then on the morning of the 8th, the aircraft landed on the Haneda Airport in Tokyo, and then brought the capsule to the Sagamihara campus of JAXA. Now it's hiding in a curation facility for careful examination. It's gonna take a long time to open this capsule. If we somehow make a mistake and let the Earth's atmosphere in, that's the end of we can still do some good science, but the one of the advantages of Earth contamination free property will be lost. So they're having a very, very hard intense moment of preparation of opening the capsule. So that's what. Oh, I'm sorry.
So can you talk a little bit about how you are keeping this sample safe from contamination and protecting it while it's being examined?
Yes. There are three elements. Number one is that the capsule has to have a very vacuum seal. That was one of the main advancement from the original Hayabusa. Hayabusa had the resin type sealing of the capsule. It was not necessary to have a high vacuum sealing, but this time it's a very tight metal vacuum sealing, which is used in high vacuum conditions in Earth's high precision laboratory on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then the number two was the timing. As I mentioned a little bit, the amount of time they were allowed to spend from arrival of the capsule to the ground to the retrieval and then enclosure with the contamination-free environment is only 72 hours. I have to check back. I think it was 72 hours. And then it was done much shorter time than that amount of time. So that was really extra successful. And then the third element is, of course, the ground facility. The ground facility has been extremely clean. And then the capsule was put it into the system. And then after thorough cleaning of the capsule inside of the vacuum chamber, it would be opened. And then the facility has a very tight control of people. I will have a chance to go down there to make a measurement of a sample later on, but no, I cannot come in, let's say today. only people who are really needed to do the analysis are allowed to come in. Even the facility manager, the person who is in charge of the whole thing, cannot be get in because it's just a source of dust and the contamination. That's how they control the contamination, and hopefully that'll work out.
You're listening to Astronomy News with the Cosmic Companion, a podcast focused on making science accessible to everyone, including weekly interviews with groundbreaking scientists. We depend on support from fans like you, helping us bring science news and education directly to listeners around the globe. Visit us at thecosmiccompanion.net/support for information on subscriptions and other ways you can help support this program. Subscriptions start at just 99 cents a month. Show your love of astronomy and space exploration by visiting thecosmiccompanion.net/support today.
Wow. So we know, and so of course, obviously, as you said, it's only been a week or so since it's landed. But do we know anything at all so far about the sample? Go ahead. Yeah. What do we know?
Yeah. One thing they have announced so far is that they could detect some kind of gas from the chamber that was measured back in Australia. That was exactly how it was planned. I thought, well, it is in common sense. It's not that easy. The material was exposed to the space, you know, super ultra high vacuum for at least thousands of years, if not millions of years. So the gassing must have happened, but they could detect some gas that's not from our Earth. So that's great news. Yeah, so it tells us two things. One is that there is an ample sample inside. Number two, it's got some fresh material. It's not really all dried out. So it's as promising as it could be. I'm a little bit worried because all the news are too good. Yes, if there's some little problem, that's like, all right, yeah, this is the reality. But that's the level. They have been very, very cautious, and so far it's good. Yeah, so that's where we stand.
Yeah. And I probably have an interview just about the gas, tell you the truth. But so how are you handling the sample? Like when NASA got its, you know, moon samples from the Apollo missions, if they, you know, were really strict about handling it. But some samples got sent out to universities and organizations around the world. How are you handling distributing this precious material? Yeah.
We knew that once we have a sample, everybody wants to have it. And it's good to really distribute among the best scientists of the world. At the same time, somebody has to be there and then do the so-called curation to really characterize, this is a big piece, this is a small piece, and this is darker than the other, who gets what? And those called the initial curation. And then they have talked about the geochemists and sample analyzing people have talked about it for a long time. And then 40% will be stored in for future research. We are still learning more and more. But the rest of the 60 will be used for the analysis in the relatively near future, like maybe 6 months through a few years, maybe a little bit more. Then 30%, well, I don't need to really explain that, you know, huge detail, but the generally 30% including the initial curation process and the initial analysis will be done in Japan. So the Japanese scientists will have the hands-on to those samples. Yeah. But rest of the 30% goes to the international science community. And then, the out of the 30, 15 has been already assigned to space agencies and then some other universities overseas. And then NASA actually gets the 1/3 of the international allocation, which is 10% of the total amount of mass. It's the biggest share of any single organization receives. But this is because NASA helped us for the operation greatly. And also we have a PAC agreement with the OSIRIS-REx to exchange respective samples. So we provide, OSIRIS-REx team with the sample analysis, and then they get to analyze it before their arrival of their own sample, which is going to help. Yeah, but we'll get their samples. Luckily, they have an ample amount of samples.
A little more than they were expecting to get.
Yeah, it was so large amount that it was kind of like falling away. But some media covered that, oh, it was leaking, but I think it's like an overspill, just so much of, well, I'm not there, but that's the impression I received. So they get the sample, we will get OSIRIS-REx's sample, and then we'll have laboratories who are used to, who practice with the HiOPSEC-2 or rigorous samples, then make a comparison with the OSIRIS. And then OSIRIS and the HiOPSEC-2 are pretty much simultaneous mission. So the same laboratory, same people can get to use those different types of samples. So the level of expertise is not going to deteriorate in a year, matter of 3 years. Probably it's going to just increase. And that was kind of happening, what was happening during the Apollo era, because Apollo was not just a single mission. Apollo 11 received sample, 12 was going to receive, 13 didn't work out, but in a major heroic story, and 14, 15, 16. So the laboratory are really working hard back then to really sharpen their really techniques over the years of time, not as extensive and massive as Apollo time, but this 1-2 mission with a very similar asteroid, but the clearly different asteroid, with a different amount of water, and then probably organics types are quite different. Oh, wow. If I was your chemist, I'd be really looking at my microprobe every day. It's really worth doing. So that's what we are trying to achieve. You know, reality is not as ideal as I just depicted, but that's what we are trying to do. And then those portion numbers, 40%, 30%, 30%, future us, and then the international science community, that's the number we're trying to project our thoughts in, and then that makes some important impression to the science community and then the rest of the world.
Yeah, it sounds like there's going to be some great science coming out of it. And so finally, you know, Hayabusa 2 came and dropped the capsule containing this, you know, material off at Earth, and then it took off, leaving the gravitational grip of the Earth. And where is it headed? What's next for Hayabusa 2?
Right. The next goal or destination is another asteroid. It's called a 1998 KY26. It was hard to remember, but now I think I remember it correctly. And it's a very interesting asteroid. It's a small asteroid, only 30 meters across, about 100 wow. feet across. It's just a little slightly larger than the large meteorite that fell on Russia, Chelyabinsk, town of Chelyabinsk in Russia. I think it's 2013. About 7 years ago, and they made a huge shock wave, and then broke lots of glass windows, and they injured right. 3,000 people. And that was estimated to be about 18 meters, about 20 meters, so two-thirds of KY-26. And then this guy, KY-26, getting close to the range of a size that could really fall on the Earth. And then knowing the properties of those small asteroids are going to be extremely useful for protecting ourselves from a possible upcoming impact on civilization. And hopefully we may be able to redirect the orbit and so forth. That's one thing. And then the second thing is that the properties of KY-26 is that it's a so-called fast rotator. It probably has a similar shape. The radar has we have a radar image. The radar astronomers have found the general shape. It's a potato shape. It's like a round, not elongated like a Itokawa, but it spins every 10 minutes. It's very fast. Ryugu has a 7.6 hours of a rotation period. Compared to that, it's really fast rotating. So it's maybe monolith, but it could be, again, a tightly interlocked rubble pile. A rubble pile is an assemblage of asteroid made by small fragments kind of clustered together, just like Ryugu. And then knowing those natures of fast rotators, and then the internal structure would be extremely interesting and for understanding the origin of the asteroids and the evolution of the solar system. And that's the two major goals. But it takes 11 years to get there. So it's a very long, long journey. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to really preserve the spacecraft. We have to get them, well, not really in a physical hand, but with the command line. Well, you did a good job. But he or she, no, doesn't have to have a gender, but the Hayabusa 2 has a very quiet journey to a new destination. And hopefully we will do some interesting science by using cameras or spectrometer, looking at the different objects in the solar system, and then finding out those undiscovered properties of the solar system. We have to find out what we're going to do in some time. Okay. So that's the plan.
Well, thank you so much for being on this show, Seiji. It's great talking with you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. And that was Professor Seiji Sugita of the University of Tokyo, researcher on the Hayabusa 2 mission.
Next week, we welcome Dr. Paul Kalis from UC Berkeley to the show. He is an astronomer who is a leader on the study of the exoplanet HD106906b, which might resemble an unseen planet X in our own solar system. Tune in for this episode coming December 22nd. Join us each week on Astronomy News with the Cosmic Companion as we bring space and astronomy news together with groundbreaking scientists speaking directly to listeners and viewers around the globe. And we depend on support from viewers just like you. To help support this program with a one-time donation or a paid subscription starting at just 99 cents a month, please visit thecosmiccompanion.net/support. Please stay safe, stay healthy, and keep your wonder alive. If you enjoyed this episode of Astronomy News with the Cosmic Companion, please download and share the episode on YouTube, Facebook video, or on any major podcast provider. For more details on space and astronomy news, please visit thecosmiccompanion.com or thecosmiccompanion.net.